This podcast was recorded Thursday, March 27th at 1:22 p.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like people will learn that when you text something, texting, even on Signal, is forever. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who denounce one security breach, but then say another is no big deal. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, an energy bill, an Ohio energy bill that just about everyone is happy with. When has that ever happened? But first, we all hate taxes. They cut into our paycheck. There is federal taxes, state taxes, city taxes, state sales taxes, county sales taxes, property taxes for schools, for parks, for zoos. We can't choose which taxes we pay or how much tax we want to pay. We have to pay them or we go to jail. So if you're a politician who wants to get elected, you don't need a stepladder to pick the fruit that is promising tax cuts. So Republican candidates for governor are harvesting. To discuss the latest proposal, we turn to a panel of State House experts, reporters Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio and Jake Zuckerman from Cleveland.com, alongside OSU political scientist Herb Asher and former state legislator Gene Krebs. Eliminating a third of the state's tax revenue base is a major platform for top Republicans running for governor, Dave Yost and Vivek Ramaswamy.
We need to bring down the income tax, eventually down to zero, because you deserve to keep what you earn. It is your money, not the government's.
It is taxpayers' money that pays for roads, bridges, schools, health care, and those incentives to attract companies like Intel. But supporters say Ohio would attract more jobs if it eliminated the income tax. Opponents say eliminating the income tax mainly benefits upper-income residents and would require increases in other taxes, like sales taxes, which have a greater impact on those with lower incomes. Gene Krebs, let's put politics aside for a moment. Logistically, how would the state accomplish eliminating the income tax?
It would be very painful. It could happen, but something happened 2 days ago that I think I would now encourage everybody to take a very much a go-slow approach on this, and that was an email I had sent to me from a group of economic development financial folks who specified how their budgets have been sliced by 85%. And these are the folks, these are not the salesmen for economic development projects. These are the folks that put together the financial packages. And where they have the most impact is going to be in the rural and the underserved areas. But here's the real thing that's going to happen. So what this does at the federal level, it dampens down state-by-state competitiveness when it comes to giving away the store. Now this means that the rich states can replicate these federal programs by Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, okay? And it's going to be a struggle for us. And then at the other, at the same time, we all know what's going to happen, or we think we know. The common knowledge, the common wisdom is that at the federal level, they're going to take all the great society welfare programs, put them into a block grant, cut it by half, and send it to the states and say, you take care of it.
So basically, there's not going to be enough money to pay for these programs, what you're saying, on the state level.
It's going to be huge disruptions that will be politically untenable.
So, Jake, this is a third of the state budget. What's the plan to do away with the income tax?
Well, I think we haven't heard a plan. I mean, this is a huge, huge chunk of revenue to take away. Most of the state's money goes to incarceration, education, and medication, really through the Medicaid program. I just pulled some numbers. These are from 2023. The state sales tax was about $13.7 billion in revenue versus $11.3 billion in income taxes, $3.6 billion in local sales taxes. So this is like cutting off your leg. How are you going to walk around? And if this isn't paired with a coherent plan of these are the spending, this is the $10 billion in spending we are not going to spend anymore, it sounds like an empty promise to me.
Joe, Mike DeWine doesn't want this. He kept the he didn't call for an income tax cut even in his budget.
Right. He did not. And in fact, he called for some taxes to fund some things and he called for other taxes. But here's the thing. You know, look at the income tax right now. It's there's two brackets and the highest bracket is what, 3.5, 3.75. So it's not that much. Right. In the scheme of things, it's not like we're talking 20 years ago where you had a significant income tax. And if you look at what we don't tax in Ohio, that some of the income tax free states tax. For example, a car. When you go to register a car in some states, it's thousands of dollars to register a car because you're paying a fee on that. Well, you know, that can offset that income tax very quickly. There are other fees that are in other states, gas and oil, different things that happen. So it's taking care of that income tax and getting no income tax might make some people happy, but what do you have to do to get there?
Would it not attract some people to Ohio, or would prevent some people from leaving Ohio, perhaps at retirement age, to go to a place like Florida, Texas, with no income tax?
Well, if they could abolish the income tax and make winters warmer and sunnier, they might do that. But look, when Ramaswamy first mentioned this down in Cincinnati a while ago, he didn't have the careful conditions. He said, let's get rid of it. And he also talked about the property tax. Yep. And he also talked about how wonderful homeschooling was. So some friends of mine thought, oh, here's how he's going to do it. We're going to encourage people to do homeschooling, and then we won't need teachers and we won't need buildings. And therefore, in fact, you can make it work. Dave Yost, I think, has been more responsible from the very beginning, saying, you got to do it gradually. You got to recognize there are trade-offs. You have to. You just can't say you're going to do this. And Ramaswamy, this is. I think he did not help his credibility by the way he first approached it. And now he's backed off. The clip you showed, he said, "Well, we got eventually."
Yeah.
Alaska has no income tax, but it's not being inundated by blue-haired widows from Bexley.
Okay. Also has a lot of oil drilling.
Yes,
that. Yeah, yeah. They have other forms of income. The other thing I have to say, in 1997, let's go back in time, George Victor Voinovich, when governor, proposed a sales tax increase. I was one of the leaders against it because my farm is 3.8 miles from the Indiana line. And I knew, so let's take all of this. Let's say our sales tax goes the same way as Florida. It has no income tax, but sales tax, I think, is 10 or 11%. There would be no restaurants and no stores in Preble County, let me tell you, because you would conduct everything over in Indiana.
Wouldn't you have to also force cities to eliminate their income tax? Because, the Columbus income tax is nearly as high as the middle level of Ohio's income tax, the state income tax.
I mean, the way I like to think about this is you look at all these political fights of the day. We want to build the Browns a new stadium. Everyone wants their property taxes in Columbus to be lower. Everyone's getting squeezed by that. The more revenue you are chopping off, the harder every one of those decisions is going to be to make. There will be more scarcity, so more people will be left without. So I come back to this point of until someone explains what we won't spend money on, I don't see how you can just slash this much revenue.
Yeah. Here's a question. Will we ever see a tax increase again?
Wow. You might hear chatter about that if we have a depression like the 1930s and we have to totally restructure. But to build upon what Jake brought up, 1930s, we have the tax structure from the 1930s because back then you conducted all your economic activity within 5 miles of where you lived. You don't do that now. And because of that, the state acts as basically a big income redistribution methodology.
And if you needed more money, the state would be more likely to say, rather than raising the rates, let's expand the base upon which we collect the sales tax and let's eliminate some of the income tax exemptions.
Or fees. There would be a lot of fees.
Yes. Don't raise taxes, but don't raise tuition, increase the fees. Yeah. Don't raise taxes, increase the fees.
Leave it to Gene Krebs. Tax the bejeebies out of us. We'll try to find a definition for bejeebies during the break.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Snollygoster. Our discussion continues with that energy bill moving through the State House that most everyone is happy about.
The bill is designed to help Ohio adjust to a sharp increase in demand for electricity. New data centers and advanced manufacturing plants require a lot more power. The bill would make it easier to build new power plants. It includes provisions that make it tougher for utilities to increase electric rates and tack on fees to customer bills. It eliminates those subsidies to those coal plants that were in the scandalous nuclear bailout law known as HB6. It does, however, end direct subsidies to some solar energy projects. I begin by asking reporter Jake Zuckerman, why the bipartisan love? What's the magic of this bill that won Democrat support?
Yeah, I'd go past just bipartisan support. With the exception of utilities, all the major political players were behind, the manufacturers were behind this. The Consumers Council, who advocates for lower bills for residential customers, were behind this. This coalition that you never see on the same page were on the same page. Now, one thing to consider is this is long-term economic thinking. The idea of this bill is we're going to reset some of the market conditions, and like its sponsors say, we're going to level the playing field a bit, and there's a pretty substantial property tax cut for new generation in the field. So they're hoping that by rejiggering the air we breathe, you know, the base level market conditions, that they're going to spur, they talk about an all the above strategy, but realistically we're talking about natural gas generation, private natural gas generation for these data centers, and the end of those coal bailouts like you mentioned.
I'm former chair of the Ohio Consumers Council, and so I'm probably the third most hated person by the utilities in the state. And I will tell you, when I saw the early drafts of this, I just kind of went, this will never pass. The utilities will do everything in their power to kill it. It passed. I still feel like I'm living on bizarro world. We got everything we wanted.
What's the best thing you got, the consumers got?
Elimination of the ESPs.
What are those?
Electric standardization.
Electric security plans.
That increases your bills? What does that do?
It gives the PUCO basically carte blanche to go ahead and do a whole bunch of silly riders on everything. Basically, you talk about, as a conservative, we're supposed to be anti-tax. They have been taxing the bejeebies out of people via their electric bills for the past 20 years, and nobody except for me and five other people have given a hoot.
So, Herb, did this pass and satisfy the consumer groups because of House Bill 6 and the scandal around the bailout law, or is it just...
Well, partly that, but also the recognition that the need for additional electricity is upon us now. And so nobody wants to be in the position of having blackouts in the summer. You know, remember, our grid is not that great. It's part of what the Northeastern grid. Canada is sort of threatening us a little bit, but... So you don't want to really have these brownouts or blackouts or whatever. So with the increased demand, they needed to do something. And this one is more plausible. It's actually less painful or whatever. Yeah. And notice that we still don't really believe in renewables in Ohio.
That was my next question, the joke. So it makes, you know, it easier to set up power plants. It helps consumers a little bit by making it tougher to raise rates and put on extra fees. But it cuts out the subsidies to solar.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a big deal. That's a big deal for a lot of people. A lot of farmers hate the solar plants, you know, because they take, you know, the farmland
and
that sort of thing.
Unless you want to sell your farm to a solar manufacturer.
Right, right. Exactly. But the one thing I want to mention is this bill doesn't do a very critical thing, and that is address the problems at the PUCO that allowed House Bill 6 to move forward and perpetuate like it did. Mm-hmm. Because there are not structural changes to the way the oversight is handled in situations involving energy. And if there is another scandal like a House Bill 6, I mean, where are the safeguards there to try to catch that? That hasn't been addressed.
The PUCO reform is a long-going thing. That's one of the things we need to look at.
So, I mean, I remember past deregulation bills, electric deregulation bills, was going to be great. It didn't quite work out that way, Jake. Is there any concern that this is not all it seems cracked up to be?
Yeah, well, for one, on the renewables point, there's still an unbelievable amount of power at the local level to kill renewable projects that is entirely unique to renewable, and especially in the solar industry. It is just choking the solar industry out. I mean, we have seen developers' interests really plunge since 2021 legislation took effect. As far as generation goes and deregulation, I think you still hear a lot of political support for that. There are more voices, Senator Lou Blessing from Cincinnati coming out saying we should re-regulate. Regulation being give the utilities ownership and control of these generation assets. But I think there's still a pretty wide-standing belief that this has been good for customers. If you give customers the chance to shop around for where they buy their electricity from instead of just whatever the utility happens to want to give you, they will save money. You will realize savings.
For solar, there's a technological thing that, so by 2030, if trends continue, and they've been going this way now for 40 years, solar energy will cost 1 penny per kilowatt in 2030. And when I talk to my friends about who understand this stuff, who go, what happens when basically solar becomes free electricity? What does that do? They all look at me and go, so how is that ribeye sandwich? No one can get their mental arms around that. It's just too, it becomes free. What do you do with that then?
When Jimmy Carter died, one of the things they described was how he had solar panels on the White House. This is 76 to 80. And then when Reagan came in, they took the panels down. And you start thinking, if we had been more serious about solar 40 years ago, imagine the solar industry, manufacturing industry would have, and imagine how, you know, it might be 5, 6, 7, 8, 10% of our electricity generation. Yeah.
That was OSU political scientist Herb Asher, former state legislator Gene Krebs, and State House reporters Jake Zuckerman from Cleveland.com and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio. Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past week. And this week, we give it to former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, who this week announced he is forming the Dignity of Work Institute. You know, when you think of an institute, you think of old white men wearing tweed jackets and bow ties, sitting in high-back leather chairs, contemplating the world's problems. You don't generally picture men and women wearing Carhartts. Anyway, this institute claims to better understand the lives of American workers. It will poll workers, interview them, conduct other research. It's part of Sherrod Brown's effort to bring both parties to better understand the working class. And it is part of Brown's effort to remain in the spotlight while he figures out if he wants to run for governor, for U.S. senator, maybe even president in the next few years. And for that, for remaining in the spotlight, Sherrod Brown gets our Snollygoster of the Week award. That'll do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast, and just tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.